is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Normally, it's Friday, and apologies for not making it in here for a live show yesterday. The city got slammed, and some of our key employees could not make it in, and so, you know, that's what happens. We've got to do a better job of coming up with plan Bs here, I think, in the future. But in any case, we're here, we're live, and Bernie is typically with us this hour, but he's actually on his way down to Selma right now for this weekend is the 50th anniversary of the Selma March, and Senator Sanders will be down there. I just learned, and I'm surprised I learned it this way by looking on democraticunderground.com, that Bernie has apparently what looks like a campaign page in his campaign to run for president. If you go to BernieSanders.com, what you'll see is what looks like a Bernie Sanders. It doesn't say president anywhere, but it's like, you know, help him run the campaign and everything. And Bernie.org is his official, campaign for Senate kind of website. So this BernieSanders.com looks to me like the, you know, sort of like, you know, ready for Hillary or whatever it is. You know, it's that's really interesting. I wanted to postulate something. By the way, since Bernie's not with us today, we do have a couple of guests who are going to be coming in the, at 1:20, John Ennis is going to be with us. He's got a documentary out called Pay to Play. And in the third hour, Professor Richard Seeger is going to be with us about what's going on with global warming. But for this first hour, there's a bunch of things I want to share. There's a couple of stories here I'm going to share with you. But just I find this fascinating. I want to juxtapose two stories that are in the news right now and hopefully get you thinking a little and maybe talking, and maybe we could ultimately even see some interesting change in the United States. Now, on the one hand, one of the two stories is about Ferguson. The Department of Justice has found that the Ferguson Police Department essentially decided that their primary goal, their job, was not to police the community. It was not to serve and protect. It was not to, you know, defend the citizens. That their principal job was to raise money. This is what the Department of Justice found, that the largely white police department spoke of their largely black citizens in derisive terms. They made jokes about Obama. You know, he's not going to be more than a one-term president because black men can't hold a job for more than 4 years. Blah-dee, blah-dee, blah. I mean, it's just, it was horrible. It's a freak show. And the city had, in 1 year, had raised over $2 million just from ticketing people. Every black person in Ferguson knew that if they got in their car or even walked down the street in the wrong way. No, seriously, in Ferguson, walking down the street the wrong way, which is apparently what Michael Brown was doing, by the way. Officer Darren Wilson did not know that Brown at that point in time was a suspect in a robbery. He stopped him because he was walking in the street, on a street that has no sidewalks in Ferguson. And walking in the street is illegal, and you can get a ticket for it. And this is how this city built $2 million worth of billing in a year from a largely poor African-American, working poor African-American community of just, you know, 20, 30,000 people. I mean, it's just, they're just extracting money from people like there's no tomorrow. On the TV show last night, we had a guest on, Goldie, I'm forgetting her last name. Taylor? Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Goldie Taylor. Who talked about how, you know, in black communities all over America, everybody knows, hey, if you get in your car, if you've got the smallest thing wrong, I mean, if there's a piece of mud over your license plate that obscures a number, if you've got a dead taillight, if you've got a dead bulb over your license plate, anything that might be wrong with your car, or if you're not wearing your seatbelt or whatever, you will get nailed. And I said to her, and she said, you know, I'm in my 40s and it's been this way my whole life. And I said to her, well, I'm, you know, a bit older than that, and I don't remember this. And then it suddenly hit me. I don't remember it because I'm white and I grew up in middle class communities. I mean, I grew up in the southern side, on the south end of Lansing, Michigan. It was a solidly blue collar working class neighborhood. My dad bought the house that we lived in 1956 for $13,000. It was a 3-bedroom, 1-bath. And it was me and dad and mom and my 3 younger brothers, 6 of us. But it was, you know, it was a white neighborhood. So when the police came through, you know, we didn't run, we didn't freak out, we didn't worry. I just never had that experience. We lived in Vermont, and I remember there was one spot on Highway 14, as I recall. Maybe it was 41, whatever the main highway was there that ran through Montpelier, Route 12, whatever. Anyhow, everybody knew where the speed trap was, right? Just like in a lot of towns. You know, everybody knows where the speed trap is. So it's not like they are preying on members of the community. They're there to nail tourists, which, you know, in a state like Vermont, where tourism's a major part of it, that makes a certain amount of sense. And they're not doing it based on, you know, racial criteria. But in Ferguson, they were nailing the citizens of the town that they were raising the money for. Okay, so that's story one. I said, I want to juxtapose two stories. That's story one. We got a problem. We're funding our police departments with fines from speeding tickets and whatnot, running red lights, and we are targeting minorities in poor areas in order to fund these police departments. Now, pop on across the pond over to Finland. In Finland, a fellow by the name of Rima Kisla is a businessman, was driving down the street in a 50-mile-an-hour zone, 80 kilometers per hour, 50 miles an hour, and he was going 64 miles an hour. He's going 14 miles over. He gets pulled over. He gets a ticket. When the city or when the country, whatever the jurisdiction was, looks up Rima Kisla's income, they discover that this guy, based on his, you know, last year's income, had a salary in the neighborhood of $10 million. So the fine that they hit him with for his speeding ticket was $60,000. Figuring that a guy who makes $10 million a year, for him, a $60,000 fine for speeding is about the same as somebody who makes $50,000 or $60,000 a year getting a $50 ticket for speeding. See, in Finland, the ticket is a function of how wealthy you are. Now, consider how this would change the profile of the people that police are looking to stop in Ferguson. If they knew that if they stopped rich white guys, they could, you know, instead of the ticket being a $50 ticket, it could be a $5,000 ticket. Hey, you stop, David Koch. I mean, the ticket could be $10 million. Right? These guys made well over $1 billion last year, each of them. Is it time for us? In fact, the most famous, back in 2002, there was a Nokia executive in Finland who made 14 million euros, and he was hit with a 116,000 euro fine. This is, he got about a $125,000 speeding ticket because he made $16 million a year. Good idea? I think so. What do you think?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Should we start basing speeding tickets on the income of the speeder rather than just some flat number? Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Carol in Republic, Michigan. Hey, Carol. Anything goes Friday. What's up?
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I just wanted to bring into the conversation in respect to Ferguson. As a white person, it certainly seems to me that these policemen across the country take great pride and joy in terrorizing the black communities across the country. I would like to know why a smart attorney hasn't taken a police department to court for domestic terrorism charges. It seems to me that what they've done in Ferguson is blatantly obvious. It is.
Well, they are being prosecuted, Carol.
Yes, I know, but let me go back to Darren Wilson, if we may. It strikes me that, and I think it was discussed or published somewhere, where they had various competitions within that police department, who could terrorize the most and who could terrorize the best. And I know I'm going out on a limb here, but is it really that far to go out on a limb to say that why doesn't anybody bring up the possibility that these policemen had competition for who could kill the most black people? I think that what they've done in Ferguson is what they do across our country. I think that the black voice is muted in our country. I think that since we have a black man in the White House, it has become so over the top. The white power structure is scared to death that they are going to lose power, and they are going to put the black people and the poor white people in their places so that the white power structure can never be toppled or threatened again. And President Obama is exactly that, a threat to the white power structure. I will hang up now, and thank you for taking my call, and thank you for sure. listening to my thoughts.
Sure. My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you, Carol. I wouldn't have said it. Thank you very much for the call. I wouldn't have said it exactly the way you said it, but and I think calling police departments terrorists is probably not going to be a useful dialogue to have, at least in the context of white America. I think that if you ask most black Americans, the idea of police departments as terrorists actually seems quite familiar and makes a lot of sense. And one of the big challenges that we have is how do we help white people in America figure out what it's like being black in America? Most white Americans have no idea what white privilege is, and therefore have really no idea of what the black experience in this country is like, or for that matter, the Latino or Asian or any other, or for that matter, the most white men have no idea what it's like to be a woman, or the challenges that women face, particularly in the workplace, but every place else in our society. So I don't disagree at all that we need to be having conversations, particularly about how the powerful treat the powerless, whether they are police dealing with minorities by and large or poor people in their community, working poor, or whether it's the business power structure and how it deals with people. Whatever it may be, how the powerful deal with the powerless in our society is a huge, big deal. And we need to be having that conversation. Thank you, Carol, for the call. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Okay, that was just the beginning. There's an enormous amount of amazing stuff in the news right now. There was one in particular that I thought was just hysterical I wanted to share with you. Yeah, this was Babylon Sister post over at DU, but it started with our good friend Annie Borowitz. In what could be a prelude to announcing a presidential candidacy in 2016, on Friday, Joe Biden released both emails he has written while serving as vice president for the past 6 years. In releasing the two emails, Biden took pride in announcing that he had sent them both from his official government email address, adding, "I have nothing to hide." The first email, written to President Obama in December of 2009, asks about the time and place of the White House Christmas party. The second and last email, written in May of last year, asked the president, "Is our internet slow today? I'm trying to watch something." According to Biden's records, the president did not respond to either email. Yeah. Thank you, Andy Borowitz, borowitzreport.com. And Amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Liz in Columbia, Missouri. Hey, Liz, welcome to the program.
Hi, a great discussion so far. I just want to add a little nugget to the conversation about tickets, speeding tickets and such. I was at University of Manchester in England around 89, 90, and they were proposing such laws back then, and I don't know if they did anything in England. I doubt it. But the reasoning behind it was that a $50 ticket to someone who's a millionaire, I mean, it just doesn't even mean anything to them at all.
Correct.
And they really were, you know, looking at the idea. Of course, over here, racism is such an entirely different aspect to it. But, and I love your observation about how they might just start going after white people instead.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a really interesting issue. And if you want to make the penalty sting, I mean, you know, that's what you're going to have to do. Interesting. Liz, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, what this brings up to mind is what constitutes equal justice?
As in the 14th Amendment?
Yeah. For instance, this guy who was a speeder who makes $10 million a year, if he's just going to get a $50 or $60 ticket for speeding, for him, that's just the price of going fast.
Right.
And so what we have in a misunderstanding in this country is what equal is. People say that, for instance, the flat taxers say, well, same percentage for everybody, but that's not proportionate because there are different ways to think of equal. I mean, you could say, what if everyone were to pay equal amounts of taxes? Well, you know, whatever particular X number that was wouldn't be equal because it would be a different proportion on everybody else.
Right.
Or different. It would mean a different proportion to each person's life who makes a different income. I've suggested, how about an equal logarithmic tax? I mean,
Jefferson actually proposed that. He said that if wealth should threaten the republic, then that excess wealth should be reduced by the law of geometric proportion, as I recall was his phrase.
That's exactly right, and that's what the Koch brothers are doing, and the ultra-wealthy in this country are threatening the republic. So Jefferson was right on that's what I would do. I would tax them on a geometric logarithmic basis.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'll give you an example here. They just raised the transit fare, which is fine with me, but they raised it a quarter for everybody. Okay, but see, everybody from the elderly to the disabled pay different amounts to begin with, right? The disabled pay, whatever, 75 cents. The youth pay a buck and a quarter. Regular riders pay 225. So when you raise everybody by a quarter, that's a different percentage to everyone.
Right.
And I called them, and they said, well, everybody got the same hike. I said, no, not that they really. You are looking at it in exact number terms. You're not even looking at it in percentage terms.
Right.
So when we look at justice in this country, as they apparently do in other countries, we need to look at it in terms of at least proportionate justice.
Mm. Yeah. And the, you know, ultimately with any law, and particularly with arguably this is falls into the kind of tax code area, when you're talking about a tax or any kind of fee or fine or whatever, you have to ask yourself, what is the goal of the legislation? You know, if, for example, if we're going to give people a tax break for mortgage interest, what is the goal of that? It's to cause more people to buy their houses rather than rent, to encourage home ownership. I mean, taxes do two things. They, okay, number one, raise revenue. Number two, incentivize or discourage behavior. And
also, yeah, we see the same thing with regard to civil penalties on banks and corporations.
Right.
And
I would argue that in both areas, having a millionaire pay a $50 speeding ticket or having a guy who makes, you know, $50 a day pay a $50 speeding ticket are not equal justice under the law, to use your phrase, Paul.
Okay.
That they are very, very different things in both regards. There's a very different incentive in terms of behavior, number one, and there's a very different amount of money raised for the coffers of the municipality or whatever the jurisdiction may be. Paul, excellent points. Thank you very much. Always great to hear from you. 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Anything Goes Friday. Bernie's on his way down to Selma. Be sure and check out the festivities. I'm guessing it'll be on TV over the weekend, if not all over the Internet and whatnot. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Anything Goes Friday. Senator Sanders is on his way to Selma right now. So he's not going to be able to be with us today. He's en route throughout our show. He sends his regards. And check out BernieSanders.com. BernieSanders.com. It's an amazing site. Shirley in Wheeling, West Virginia. Hey, Shirley, what's on your mind?
Well, I was just calling, Tom, to mention that I think the previous callers were right on the nose with what they've been suggesting. However, it's not just black and white. It's not just race. I find that the poor people are the ones that are being attacked. And so I think we need a hero to rise up in the Democratic Party and stand up for the poor and the black folks, because in this area, white people are having their property, homes, cars, and money confiscated on small charges, and it's just a horrible thing. And maybe Hillary needs to pick a great running mate. You know, one of the Castro brothers, they're wonderful. But I think the Department of Justice really does need to stop funding the drug task force that's taking over and being too powerful in the country. They're just making it a police state.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't altogether disagree. And your point that it's not in Ferguson, it's, you know, white cops going after black citizens, but you could also argue that it's middle class and upper middle class and policies being made by wealthy class people targeting poor people. And in West Virginia, where most of your population is white, you'd make an excellent point, Shirley, being in Wheeling, West Virginia. And
it's very scary.
Yeah. And this and frankly, I think that the police would be less interested in, you know, stopping you in your car with the idea that they could impound your car or make a couple $100 off you, if they knew that the amount of money that they could get out of you was based on your income, they'd be much more interested in the guy driving a Beamer, you know, or a Maserati. Yeah. Holy cow, let's make sure he's not speeding. So,
yeah, but it's a shame they're arresting poor people and taking their homes and their cars and the money. And it goes into the kitty then to get more cops and more, you know, it's just a scary, awful thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I hope you guys could help us. And, you know, I mentioned a hero. If somebody would pop up and go against all these things, they could get elected.
Well, really. I think popular outrage is exploding in America. We are on the edge of a very populist moment. We've seen the early sprinkles of it, the early indicators of it in both the Tea Party and the Occupy movement. And I think that something much larger than that is going to happen. I suspect it's going to happen right around the 2016 election. So anyhow, we'll see how it goes and where it goes. Shirley, thank you for the call. David in St. Paul, Minnesota, listening to AM 950. What's up, David?
Yeah. Hey, Tom. Thanks for bringing the subject up. I haven't thought about this proportionality as far as, so it's a very good concept to think about. But, you know, how do minorities feel about the justice system as a whole when you look at the situation with David Petraeus? Look right at his punishment compared to a journalist or someone who isn't out making millions of dollars, you know, with engaging in speaking fees and book deals. And,
right,
you know, here David Petraeus is classified as a hero, and we're hearing the same things that we heard about George Bush. We should just move on, and he's a hero, so let's just forget about this.
Right.
Well, that doesn't apply to these minority communities. So, you know,
well, actually, you know, if you want to do a little closer to an apples and oranges compare, an apples and apples comparison, David, it would be David Petraeus versus Chelsea Manning, or David Petraeus versus Ed Snowden. The difference, though, is if my understanding and reading of what Petraeus did is right, it was sort of like, you know, he's there with Paula Broadwell, his girlfriend he's having an affair with, and he's on the phone with the president of the United States, and he's like, hey, you want to hear the president? Kind of thing. You know, I mean, it wasn't like he was spilling secrets to her so that she could publish them in the New York Times, or she could give them to, you know, Kim Jong-un. He was just bragging. And
he had access to them.
No, I understand that. But bragging is different from taking tens or hundreds of thousands of classified documents and releasing them to the press or in the larger world, every single document arguably being a crime. Now, that said, I think that we need very, very strong whistleblower protections, and I think Ed Snowden and Chelsea Manning should have been covered by those whistleblower protections. I don't disagree with just locking them up, but I think that, you know, using Petraeus as an example is it's weak, because what he did was qualitatively, I think, something quite different. But anyhow, Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what your thoughts on all of this?
Hey, Tom. You know, well, first of all, a bit of good news before I hit you with the bad news. We did. The economy still is running along. 290,000 jobs added. 5.5 unemployment.
Right.
You know, so much for the job killing American Obamacare.
Right.
So much for that theory. You know, Tom, there's a difference between hearing someone and listening. Now, you can tell me all day a story or an anecdote, and I can just listen, hear you, and not really listen and absorb what you're telling me day in and day out. To me, that was really, really crystallized with this decision, well, with the finding of the Justice Department, what's going on in Ferguson. And what I mean by that is a lot of people, and white people in particular, were shocked and surprised. And then they were shocked and surprised that that black people would tell them, hey, you know, this goes on all over the country. Yeah. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, you were hearing me, but all these decades, you were never really listening to me. I mean, I was stunned. That was the most shocking development, is how many people was shocked and stunned that this goes on in the United States of America.
Right.
It's amazing to me how many people just wasn't listening to me and people that look like me.
Well, and this is white privilege, Carl. The biggest privilege associated with white privilege is not having to think about things like that.
You know, and we're really, like what happened in New York,
Mr. Garner?
Yeah, when he spoke of his son and how he had to have the conversation that just about every black person that I know have the conversation with their children, sons and daughters,
right.
You know, the police union took offense to that. And, you know,
Bill de Blasio, yeah. Yeah.
Bill de Blasio, yes, in New York, when he was talking about his son Dante,
right.
He was telling him, like, hey, I have this conversation with my son about how to act with police. Well, white people freaked out, like, what do you mean, how do you act with police?
Right.
You know,
right.
And it goes back to my first statement. You were hearing me, but you never listened to me.
Right.
So,
well, I think it even goes beyond that, Carl. I think that there is a certain lack of empathy for people who don't have a shared experience. And this is probably the area where we can all relate to this most clearly, is men not understanding women and vice versa. But I think that this happens across races, and I think it happens across economic lines, that, you know, you and I realize, Carl, you don't mean just you yourself, but, you know, black people in America have been saying for a long, long time, look at the horrible way we're being treated by law enforcement in the United States, et cetera, et cetera. And I think you're right that white people have not been listening, or have been assuming that, you know, these were just, you know, people complaining about whatever. And the luxury that white people have is that they don't have to worry about that for themselves. And that's one of the reasons why they don't take it as seriously for black people. But this is it's not that they're not listening, is that they don't have, I think a lot of white people don't have the basis for the information to have a frame in which it can settle in their brains. I don't know how to say it quite exactly right, Carl, but it's.
And the irony of it all is that we walk the same streets every day.
Oh, yeah.
We shop in the same store. We eat in the same crappy fast food restaurants. We go to the same miserable Department of Motor Vehicles. We go to the same schools. Yeah. And it's amazing that we might as well be living on two different planets.
Yeah.
It's stunning.
And our experiences can be so different.
Have a good weekend.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Carl. Thanks. Very, very thoughtful analysis. I appreciate it. Judy in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, just fine.
Okay. Couple quick comments. If doctors can't mention guns, because you're going to infringe on someone's Second Amendment. If I tell someone to shut up, am I infringing on their First Amendment rights?
Well, arguably by the NRA's logic, yes.
Yeah, okay. Ferguson,
yeah.
Have you read the Eighth Amendment about Israel, quick and short?
Right. No. You're talking about no unusual crime punishment?
No.
Excessive punishment?
Bail should be required, nor excessive fines imposed.
Ah.
Or cruel and unusual punishment inflicted.
Right. So the question is, what's an excessive fine and what's cruel and unusual punishment? And I would argue that... Go ahead.
Yeah, not using the sliding scale. I like the Finland approach with the sliding scale based on income.
Right.
Having fines, which we don't do. Which
yeah.
Now that imposes an excessive fine on the poor.
Yeah, I am absolutely and totally with you, Judy. Thank you very much for the call. Is it time for us to consider basing our speeding tickets and other things like that, basing them on a person's income rather than on the crime they commit? If the goal of those fees is to alter behavior and raise revenue, makes sense to me.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, you know, your thoughts. It's Anything Goes Friday. There's lots of other topics, too, we can talk about. I got a big stack of news here that we're going to get through as the day goes on. Come back 15 minutes before the hour. And Milo in Bozeman, Montana. Hey, Milo, what's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech
TV.
Hey,
Tom. Hey, great discussion. One thing I'd like to point out is all these implementations of laws and changing and so forth as far as application of or fair application of the laws we have,
mm-hmm.
None of it is going to change until we get rid of the code of silence in the police department.
And how do you propose doing that?
Well, simply let the good cops know, and there are plenty of them within the police department, that they are protected. And I'm not talking about a daily work situation where you're going around, you know, tattling on the guys that you're working with, but an understanding that if you see something gross go on, that you're going to certainly be protected at every level if you point it out, and your career is not going to be over, and your life is not going to be in danger. And that's often what happens to your average good cop.
Yeah. Good point, Milo. You know, thank you very much for calling and making it. I appreciate it. Brian in Matthews, North Carolina. Hey, Brian. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hey, once again, Professor. Nice speaking with you. How are you?
I'm well. I hope you are.
Yes, sir. Yeah, and as you say, I'm doing well, but I'll get better.
Great.
I want to kind of piggyback on what the second or third to last gentleman called when he said that they hear you, but they don't listen to you.
Right, or vice versa. Yeah.
Yes. I think the bigger problem, I think, goes a little deeper than that, in that with the amount of demonization that goes on in this country, is that they don't want to believe you. And I think that's more of a choice than anything, because you're bombarded every single day, week in, week out, with a demonization. This guy's this guy's that, or what have you. So, I mean, why would they listen to you? If you're not believed and they don't want to believe it,
yeah.
Then, you know, you have a bigger problem.
Yeah. I think, though, that there's a large element of not having the shared experience. I mean, look at how many centuries women have been speaking out about, about sexual assault and, you know, about men touching them without asking and things like that. I mean, I'm just thinking back to the Academy Awards, and men don't hear it. Because they don't have that experience of life. They don't have that experience of being, you know, and objectified, frankly, for lack of a better word. I think the vast,
you know, that they're the power structure, so it so offends them that they have to quiet it down. They have to keep it,
right. And so I'd say, you know, this male female thing is not unlike the black white thing, because again, the men have more power than women do in our society. Whites have more power than blacks in general in our society. And
exactly. That goes to the larger problem in the society. Until we realize these power structures are there, they hurt everyone, not just black, not just white, not just the poor. Whoever's in charge are going to stay up there. They want to stay up there.
Yep.
So their target is going to be everyone that's under
yep.
them.
Yep, you're absolutely right. And this is why it's not just a matter of race. There's race, there's gender, there's the whole issue of, you know, Native Americans that is almost never discussed in these kind of conversations that really needs to be. I mean, that was the first and most horrible genocide on this continent. Slavery the second, another terrible and horrible genocide. And then, you know, you've got the just naked racism right now of the Tea Party types who, you know, would scream at a busload of Hispanic children. I mean, it's bizarre. Again, because they have no experience of what it would be like to be a minority child in their society. Those people would be horrified and embarrassed if they had any sense of what it was like. Brian, thank you for the call. I'm with you. Thank you. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Margie in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Hey, Margie, what's on your mind?
I think we need to overhaul our entire justice system. There's two different articles in Alternet today. One, a gentleman is in prison for 13 years for having two joints.
Right.
Three strikes, you're out. He had one conviction, I believe it was 21 years ago, and a second conviction 12 years ago.
Right.
Two joints, he's in prison for 13 years. There's a second article that an individual in California is facing life in prison for showing a gang sign on a Facebook page.
Right.
They're charging him with some, I believe, criminal conspiracy.
Right.
The person has no criminal record whatsoever. Our justice system is completely out of control.
I agree. And we have the highest incarceration rate on the planet. And the fact that we're not dealing with this as a screaming, flaming crisis slash emergency, I think, again, speaks to the fact that most of the victims of that incarceration, most of the victims of our profoundly dysfunctional criminal justice system are either people of color or people who are poor or both. And the poor and the powerless and people of color in this country, you know, we have a long history of just basically dumping on these people, you know, exploiting them, ripping them off. This is, you know, what the town of Ferguson is clearly guilty of. And if we were to look at Finland, you know, where, again, if a guy making $10 million a year gets a $60,000 speeding ticket because, hey, that's what he can afford to pay. That's the amount it takes to sting him. And, you know, this is a guy who's making almost $1 million a month. Can he afford to pay a $60,000 speeding ticket? Of course. And so maybe we need to expand this whole idea of progressive fines and payments and billing people based on what they can pay rather than just some arbitrary amount to a whole variety of lesser crimes and fees. Margie, thank you for the call. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle. Hey, Mark, you wanted to talk about affordable housing in Seattle?
Well, yeah, I should just start with the fact that Mayor Ed Murray's State of the City address had two main themes, and that was economic inequality and racial inequality. And that's in Seattle, which is supposed to be one of the most progressive cities in the country. But we've also had a Department of Justice investigation of our police department.
Right.
And a new police chief's trying to reform. But yeah, the Seattle has the highest, the fastest increasing rents in the country. We have that dishonor actually as a city right now. And it's one of the fastest developing cities in the country. It's just incredible, Tom, the amount of development that's going on and how entire blocks are disappearing overnight.
Yeah, it's happening here in D.C. too. It's the gentrification is breathtaking.
Yeah, and that's definitely part of the economic injustice for sure. Yeah. What's happening here is that there is sort of a political backlash, though, that's building. I think if somebody ran for city council right now on that issue of loss of affordable housing and gentrification, they would probably win with a lot of support from the community.
Yeah.
Because it's just out of control here. And we have no rent control. The reason for that is that the Washington State Legislature has prohibited it in any city in the state. So we have to directly apply pressure to and lobby the Washington State Legislature to overturn that, because I think our city mothers and fathers here would love to see some kind of rent control just to stop the skyrocketing rents. It's very, very expensive, unfortunately.
Hopefully in their zoning, they're requiring mixed use in these new developments. I mean, that's and a certain percentage is set aside for affordable units. That's what it more or less is being done in most parts of D.C., and it's a smart
step. A lot of activists and artists and activists and tenants, residents are getting together and trying to buy up property now and starting GoFundMe campaigns and getting grants to try to buy the buildings, because the historic preservation ordinance here don't really protect the building.
Mm.
The only way that people can really protect the property is to own it.
Yeah.
And so people are getting together with trusts and trying to just buy entire blocks to kind of save it from that kind of development. So
we'll
see what happens. It's definitely a political issue here.
There you go. Mark, thank you for the call, and thanks for raising the issue. Paul in Palatine, Illinois, you wanted to talk about Norway?
I did. Well, Tom, you alluded to a sliding scale based on the requirements for the ability to pay.
Yeah, in Finland, basically, if you get a speeding ticket, the fine you pay is a percentage of your income.
Well, as you may know, in Norway, there's pretty much a zero tolerance for alcohol use.
Yes, yes.
And yes, very much so. And this individual was a employee. He was an executive at Statoil,
mm-hmm.
which is the Norwegian
state oil company. Yeah.
Exactly. And he had had, I think, a half a beer or half a pint or whatever it is, a liter. And he got picked up, and he had to pay a fine based upon his income and his bank account. That turned out to be $128,000.
Wow. Now, I'm familiar with this, these draconian penalties in Norway, in as much as back, 30 years ago or so, the first time Louise and I went to Norway, we rented a car in Oslo, and we were and the airport's way out from town. And we're driving into town, and it's like, just out in this rural area, and there's this kid hitchhiking. And so we stopped and picked him up, thinking, hey, it's maybe he can give us recommendations of restaurants in town or whatever. And we drove him into Oslo. It was about another hour drive. And on the way, how come you're hitchhiking? The kid looked like he was maybe 19, 20 years old. And he said that he had been arrested driving. He had had two drinks in the throughout the entire course of the evening at the bar. And they had, and there was detectable alcohol. He was not drunk, but he had detectable alcohol. And so he lost his driver's license for a year. And he said if he gets arrested a second time, and he had to pay a fine, he didn't say how much, but he said the second time he gets arrested, he would actually have to spend time in jail. And they're just like really, really rigorous. Paul, thanks for the call. That's fascinating. So Norway does the sliding scale. You pay based on what at least according to Paul. Certainly we know that Finland does. This news, the BBC has picked it up, and it's all over the press about this guy getting the $60,000 speeding ticket. We'll be right back. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Beware the Ides of March, right? Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. That was actually when I was in high school. For my Latin class and my English class in 10th grade, I talked both teachers into letting me write a poem about Julius Caesar and the Ides of March. And I wrote this 4 or 5 page long, it was a masterpiece. It took me months. And when I got up in English class, and the last line of the poem was, "Beware the Ides of March." It was all about the assassination of Julius Caesar by Brutus on March 15th, the Ides of March. And I didn't even remember this until almost 2 decades later. But here I was, 15 years old, something like that, 14 years old. And my English teacher said, you know, "Tom, you wrote such a great paper. Stand up in front of the class and read it." So I got up in front of the class, and I read my 4-page poem with a lot of energy. It was a masterpiece. And then the teacher stood up next to me and said, "Class, I would like you all to look at a plagiarist. This is what a plagiarist looks like." And she went off on this rant about how there's no way that I could have written this poem. She couldn't figure out who I stole it from or where it came from, but there's no way I could have written this poem. And I wrote the poem, right? And then she told my Latin teacher, and so both my English teacher and my Latin teacher basically gave me F's on this assignment. And I was devastated. And I, at that point in time, I had 56 rejection slips that I had wallpapered my bedroom with for mostly poetry that I had submitted to magazines around the country, a couple of short stories. And I had actually published one short story in a men's magazine, of all things. But I stopped writing poetry, and I didn't even realize I stopped writing poetry. It wasn't until 20 years later, Louise and I were married. It was, I think, our 5th wedding anniversary. And I wrote her a poem for her birthday. Today, by the way, is Louise's birthday. Happy birthday, Louise. And I wrote her a poem for her birthday. And it suddenly hit me that I hadn't written a poem since I was, you know, a teenager. Because of that crazy teacher. I mean, anyway. So beware the Ides of March, right? Well, in this case, the Ides of March, March 15th, 2015, the Ides of March will be next week, I guess, next weekend, thereabouts. Today is the 6th, so 8 days from now. That is the day, according to Jack Lew, the Secretary of the Treasury, the guy holding Alexander Hamilton's old job. That is the day, according to a letter that he released today, that the U.S. government runs out of money. Because you'll remember back in December, actually it was in February that they passed the law, but in December of last year, or of the year before last, the Treasury Secretary notified Congress, okay, we're gonna run into this wall in February of 2014. And so Congress in 2014 passed what's called the Temporary Debt Limit Extension Act, suspending the statutory debt limit, in other words, allowing the government to continue borrowing money until March 15th. But as Jack Lew says, "Dear Mr. Speaker, beginning on Monday, March 16, the outstanding debt of the United States will be at the statutory limit." On Friday, March 13th, which would be next Friday, that's the second Friday the 13th in a month and a half, isn't it? Because February has 28 days. Okay, you got it. Anyhow, on Friday, March 13th, Treasury will suspend until further notice the issuance of state and local government series securities. And, you know, he goes on through this whole thing. So a whole brand new crisis, Republican-created crisis, which brings me to one other thing I wanted to raise, one other question, as it were. And that is, over the last couple of weeks, I've on a number of occasions now, when I've had conservatives on our TV show in the evening, I've said, okay, I can give you a long list of things that progressives, of changes that progressives brought about in the United States. Progressives fought for the American Revolution. Conservatives did not want there to be an American Revolution. Progressives fought against slavery. Conservatives wanted to keep slavery. Progressives fought the secession of the Union. Conservatives wanted the Union to secede. In fact, the Confederacy. They were the Confederacy. Progressives fought for Reconstruction. Conservatives fought against it. Progressives fought for an equal place in society for blacks and whites. Conservatives fought against it. Conservatives brought us Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal. Progressives fought against that. Progressives fought for women to have the right to vote, for to be enfranchised. Conservatives fought it. Progressives fought for the 40-hour work week. First the 50-hour work week. Got that in the 19-teens. Got the 40-hour work week in the 1930s. Conservatives fought against it. Progressives fought to end child labor in the United States. Conservatives fought to keep child labor. Progressives fought to have Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. Conservatives fought against every single one of those things. Progressives fought to create an agency that would determine whether our food and our drugs were safe, the FDA and the USDA. Conservatives objected to and fought the creation of both those agencies. Progressives said, we've got to clean up the air. We need an environmental protection agency. Conservatives fought the existence of the EPA. Progressives said, we've got to regulate our banks so that they don't destroy our economy again. Conservatives fought those regulations and said, no, let the banks do whatever they want. All of this kind of adds up to the history, and this, you know, you've heard my rant about this a couple of weeks ago when conservatives were talking about doing away with advanced placement history classes in all these states, that conservatives don't want AP history taught. They don't want American history taught to young Americans, because American history is the history, by and large, of progressive change. And at every single junction along the way, conservatives were on the wrong side of history. And so, you know, you could easily understand why conservatives would say, no, please don't teach American history. Conservatives did not want, you know, Martin Luther King and friends walking across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. In fact, they showed up with sticks and stones and tear gas and you know, baseball bats with barbed wire wrapped around them. It was ugly. So the question, and I keep asking conservatives this, I keep saying, can you tell me one thing since the founding of our republic that conservatives have done that has, you know, that is either policy or law that has been, you know, put into place that has actually advanced our republic, that has made America a better place? I have a long list of things that progressives have accomplished. What have conservatives accomplished? Now, typically what they'll say is, oh, well, Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. And I say, yeah, but back then the Republican Party was the liberal party. In fact, they were the radical left. They called them the radical Republicans. You know, Google Thaddeus Stevens, the guy who you know, really drove Reconstruction and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, for example. So one of the things that I would love to see, an ad, just a generic ad on television that we could run over and over and over again, that says, progressives brought you this, and it goes through this long, long list. And then it says, and conservatives brought you this, and it's just like silence. Unless maybe some of our conservative listeners can tell me any, even one thing conservatives have done.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
One thing that has made life better for average working people. I realize conservatives have done some great stuff for millionaires and billionaires, but for average working people. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's on your mind? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hey, Tom. Sounds to me like you've got at least three or four books in you. We all have one, and you've got three.
Yeah.
Writing. I would buy your book on about dealing with plagiarism, or the one about living on a boat in the dead of winter, or journeying when in your younger days when you met with people like the spiritual leaders like the Dalai Lama. Those are all interesting things to write about, and you're a gifted writer, so
get
on it.
Okay. Yes, sir. I'll take the assignment.
Three things I'd like to see that to dovetail with the idea of a progressive system of fining people for speeding and other traffic offenses. First of all, we need to get rid of the RICO statute, which was started under Reagan, where cops can take people's property with little or no consequence, which to me, that's like a totalitarian state does
right.
stuff like that. There's no democracy involved.
Yep.
Another thing we need to do is we need to institute a nationwide psychological inventory, which includes an assessment of education for all currently employed law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And make sure that there's a heavy emphasis on psychology courses, history, and civics courses. Cops need more than to be equipped with just skills on guns and tasers and nightsticks. They need people skills.
Yep.
And lastly, I'd like to see people start boycotting Hollywood movies that glorify bald-headed, middle-aged white men with wraparound sunglasses. Some Serpico movies.
And no more Bruce Willis films? Seriously?
Well, I like Bruce Willis and all, but I'm saying, you know, we've had enough of that and stuff like that. We've gone overboard. We don't glorify what it's like to be a hippie or a nerd, with the exception of the Big Bang Theory on TV. I mean, that's kind of funny, but we need more of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very interesting.
And by the way,
yeah,
this idea of these for-profit mercenary colleges that Republicans like to own, mm-hmm. we need to get rid of Everest College and University of Phoenix and start properly funding public education again.
I'm with you. Johnny, it sounds like you've got a book in you here, you know, Rebooting the American Dream. Johnny, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Valerie in Slidell, Louisiana, listening on Free Speech TV via Roku. Hey, Valerie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's on your mind?
Good. I just wanted to get back to Ferguson for a moment and mm-hmm. say that if it weren't for Republicans rolling back taxes, we wouldn't have these draconian fines on the people of Ferguson and other townships across America, because I think that is what is driving that.
Yeah.
You know, and sending more people to jail, and it just funds itself.
I think you're right, Valerie, and it would be really interesting. I hope some good investigative journalist gets on this and tracks this. Johnny was just saying, you know, this policy of I forget the legal word for it. What is it, Shane, where the police can take your stuff? There's a legal doctrine, confiscation, I think, civil forfeiture. Thank you very much, Troy. Civil forfeiture. This whole concept of civil forfeiture as a kind of preemptive thing. I need to find out the origin of that. Johnny said it started during the Reagan administration. A lot of awful stuff started during the Reagan administration. Whether that's the case or not, where it started, how it started, I need to find out. Valerie, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Roku. And we'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And John Ennis is with us. He is the director of Pay to Play, P-A-Y, number 2, P-L-A-Y .TV is the website. And Pay to Play is a documentary that is playing on Free Speech TV. Part 2 is tonight, or you can view the film in its entirety at 9:30 tomorrow and 8 o'clock tomorrow night on Free Speech TV. For additional show times and more information, go to freespeech.org. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Tom, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, or I should say welcome back. Pay to Play.
Well, Pay to Play is sort of what I described as this overall system that is blocking the Democratic voice in our country right now. You know, I set out to try to see why candidates that are really promising are at such a disadvantage when they come out from the populist groups and really face the campaign trail. And I came to realize that it's really not just the money. It's the good old boys network. And it's not just the good old boys network. It's the inherent prejudice and racism. And it's not just that. It's, you know, the Powell memo going back 40 years that have set up entire institutions and networks funding operations before you even set foot out the door. And so I set forth in this documentary to try to relay all of these things in the shape of a monopoly board. You know, you walk around a monopoly board and you see these mounting obstacles that you have to surpass as a way to try to help people wrap their mind around all these things, you know. And at the end of the monopoly board, where it would be Park Place and Boardwalk, we have corporate personhood and corporate tax dodgers, because ultimately, you know, it's this corporate ghost that is driving this endless quest for buying up our democracy.
Yeah. Yeah, remarkable. What provoked you to make this film?
Well, you know, it was interesting. I was going through Ohio making another documentary, Free for All, about what happens to our votes. And I was doing this in the wake of the disastrous elections in Ohio, moderated by Secretary of State Ken Blackwell. And as I was going through a ballot warehouse where there was just boxes of all these, you know, rotting, decaying ballots everywhere, and I'm looking at the names and I'm seeing all these, you know, some of them you know, some of them you don't know, and you're like, you know, if there were other names on here, maybe it wouldn't be such a close call. Maybe we wouldn't have to, you know, block every single person as the only way to win, you know. And why is it? Why is it, you know, that's really the bigger question. Getting the votes counted is one thing, but how the names get on the ballot, that really is the greater question. And is it, you know, is it just your famous name that gets you on? Is it your family connections? And so if I just wanted to be able to show people what the reality of that is, and so they don't get disillusioned. You know, there are ways to do it, but it takes people power. It's not just idealism, and but it really takes the concerted effort of people being really engaged.
So, where are people successfully pushing back against this pay-to-play system?
Well, that's what's the real goal of this film, ultimately, is that, you know, the third act of this, after we've set up all this stuff, the third act really becomes what I like to think of almost as activist porn. You see so much yardage suddenly captured in such a few short months by people first outing the Koch brothers, then uncovering and organizing a boycott against ALEC, and finding out that the American Legislative Exchange Council isn't just you know, a consulting group or something that hosts events, that they've actually been writing corporate-sponsored legislation for decades on state levels across the country. And so once these things are brought to light, people can organize, and we show immediate impacts, like Alex sponsors fleeing, the Koch brothers no longer being able to operate in the shadows. And so the amount of progress that people can make once they come out, they really don't even realize how many other people feel the same until they step up. And that's what Occupy Wall Street was about.
Yeah, there you go. It's great stuff. Pay to Play is the movie. P-A-Y, number two, P-L-A-Y. Pay to Play is the movie. It'll be showing, part two is showing tonight on Free Speech TV. And then the entire movie is playing tomorrow. You can get all the information at freespeech.org. You can get more information about the movie at paytoplay.tv. And, John, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom, and for appearing in Pay to Play.
My pleasure. Good talking with you. Thank you. Thank you. Benjamin in Madison, Mississippi. Hey, Benjamin, you're on the air. What's on your mind today?
Well, I was just going to talk about a couple things here. You were asking about what things conservatives have done for the country, I believe.
Yeah.
I think they need to teach the history of Theodore Roosevelt.
Theodore Roosevelt was not a conservative, Benjamin. He was a progressive.
Was he a Republican? Well, okay. All right. Was Eisenhower?
Eisenhower, well, you'd have to make up your own mind on that. Eisenhower, if you Google the 1956 platform that Eisenhower used to run for re-election for President of the United States, that 1956 platform, he bragged about the fact that over a million new people had been added to Social Security, over a million new people had been added to union roles.
Okay.
I would say no, Eisenhower was not a conservative.
That was a secondary thing. That wasn't the reason I was calling in, but the national park systems and all the things. But anyway, I think this is absolutely ridiculous, this thing about fining people based on their income.
Why?
Absolutely ridiculous.
Why?
Why? Well, let's see. The other day, I've saved up for, you know, I just turned 50, and I've saved up my whole life to buy, I won't say the name of it, but it's a high-end Italian sports car that I bought for like 40 cents on the dollar.
Right.
And I can just see me going through a small town now in this car that begins with an F. And, you know, hey, we can get more money.
You got a Ferrari, Benjamin? You got a Ferrari?
Yeah.
That's cool. You know, I used to have an Alfa Romeo, so which is, you know, way down on the food chain, but in terms of Italian sports cars. But, you know,
okay,
if you're,
but
here's the thing, Benjamin, are you saying that you are concerned that because it's an expensive car, they would be looking to pull you over?
You don't think they would? If they think, okay, we can get 10, if this guy.
So you'd rather have them just pull over poor black people?
No, I'd rather pull over people that break the law.
Okay, then great. Drive your Ferrari and don't break the law.
Well, I can give an example how that happened to me the other day and how a black person got privilege over me.
I don't think so, Benjamin. I'm sorry, we're out of time. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
I'm sure it would have been an interesting story, and hopefully we'll be able to have this conversation with Benjamin sometime when we're not up against the clock. We'll be back. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very crap-outingly ugly, the good. David Simpson, earlier this week, the Republican Texas state representative, introduced a bill that would legalize marijuana in the Lone Star State. To announce his bill, Simpson issued a statement which someone needs to put in the Hall of Fame for all-time great political statements. It said, "All that God created is good, including marijuana. God did not make a mistake when he made marijuana that the government needs to fix. Government prohibition should be for violent actions that harm your neighbor, not for the possession, cultivation, and responsible use of plants." Well said, Representative Simpson. Well said. The bad. Chris Kobach. During a recent episode of his radio show, the Kansas Secretary of State told a caller that it wasn't a huge jump for him to imagine President Obama banning, prosecuting black people. Seriously. I'm not kidding. Take a listen.
The word is going to come down that there just won't be any prosecutions of black criminals, and I can see it. I can see it happening. You know, I don't think I'm nuts for envisioning it. But
well, it's already happened more or less in the case of civil rights laws.
Now, if I can,
so I guess it's not a huge jump. I think it's unlikely, but you know, I've learned to say with this president, never say never.
Right, Chris. Somehow I don't think that's going to happen, but, you know, each his own. By the way, Chris Kobach is the guy who has compiled this massive list of voters in multiple states that the right-wing governors use to purge their voting rolls, you know, where you look at people who have last names like Jackson and Washington and stuff. Anyhow, and the very, very ugly Josh McCoon, the Republican Georgia state senator, took dirty politics to a whole new low Monday to help move forward his pro-discrimination religious liberty bill. He and other Republicans in the Georgia Senate Judiciary Committee waited until the sole Democrat present left to go to the bathroom. Then, while that Democrat was responding to the call of nature, McCoon and his Republican colleagues voted to move the so-called religious liberty bill out of committee. It's bad enough that Josh McCoon supports a bill that would allow business owners to discriminate against gay people, but the fact that he had to essentially cheat to get that bill through committee, that's very, very ugly. That's insanely ugly. Okay, Lee in Fremont, California. You wanted to talk about sliding scale traffic tickets?
Yeah, Tom, I was thinking about, you know, of course it seems like such a great idea, but unfortunately I don't think the wealthy people in this country would ever go along. They can, of course, afford lawyers who would be able to get them off the hook, and they can also, I don't know, maybe buy legislators who might write laws that would exempt them. And then those of us who are making a little bit of money, much like our progressive tax code, would probably be on the hook for the most of it.
Yeah. Well, the latter argument is why we're at where we're at right now. I mean, the Supreme Court has said that it's legal for billionaires and corporations to buy all the politicians that they want with as much money as they want. And so, you know, we have a tax code that works for rich people and corporations. We have laws that work for rich people and corporations. We've got a criminal justice system that works for rich people and corporations, and none of it works for anybody else. So I share your concern with regard to that. That's a cancer in our society that we need to fix. As far as them being able to get lawyers to get them off, though, that might be a little more of a challenge. The thing is that the really super rich, you know, the Coke level, you know, the billionaires class, many of them never drive their own cars anyway. So, you know, just to hire some minimum wage person to drive the car, and then they get the speeding ticket. And, oh, wow, you know, he only makes $7.25 an hour. You know, it's going to be a $50 ticket. I don't know how you organize that, in Finland, apparently, it's a little easier. There's not as many chauffeured limousines. But, Lee, you do raise some interesting questions. I still think, though, that the idea that if you're going to try to affect people's behavior with a fine, the fine should be large enough to affect their behavior. Thank you, Lee, for the call. I mean, Chris Christie, for example, they had documented, as I recall, over $6 billion worth of damage from the behavior of ExxonMobil over a number of decades in New Jersey. And, I mean, it was well documented. ExxonMobil had pled guilty. And the only question was how many billions of dollars in fines was the state going to ask from, you know, was going to negotiate this deal with ExxonMobil? And all of a sudden, you know, some lawyer who apparently used to work for ExxonMobil or has some connection to them and is really, really tightly tied in with the Christie for President campaign or the Chris Christie governorship or whatever it is, came in and said, we'll let them settle for pennies on the dollar, about 3 cents on the dollar. Honestly. I mean, it's just another example. Chris Christie's as corrupt as the rest of them. George in Santee, California. Hey, George.
Hi, Tom. First, let me say what a lucky guy I am to be a retiree and wake up every morning to you and Amy and Stephanie and all that group. But what my suggestion is on these traffic fines is take the money out of it and make all the fines community service. That would give rich people and poor people that common experience.
You're right. You're right. That's a very good suggestion.
I mean, somebody would have to work on that idea a little bit. Maybe we could have some small community somewhere in America, you know, experimentally try that out or something, see how it works.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great idea, George. Thank you very much for that. That's a marvelous idea. Harvey in Berkeley. Hey, Harvey, what's up?
Hi, Tom, and happy birthday, Louise.
I'm with you. Thank you, Harvey.
Sure. My pleasure. And I'd like to talk about why fracking for methane, like mosquito bites, is a vector for disease.
Okay.
As you know, mosquitoes, with their needle-like proboscis, pierce the skin and suck our blood. And while feeding on the blood, mosquitoes inject saliva into our bodies, which act as an anticoagulant to prevent blood clots. And at the same time, the saliva contains pathogens such as encephalitis, malaria, dengue fever, and the plague, which affect millions of people each year. And at the same time, hydraulic fracturing or fracking for methane can use many highly toxic liquids, such as benzene. They eject them into the ground in high pressure, and this poisons our freshwater aquifers. And here in California, we have Proposition 65 that says chemicals known to the state to cause cancer, birth defects, and other reproductive harm are found in gasoline, crude oil, and many other petroleum products. Their vapors are results from their use. So we're going to, you know, so they're essentially giving us cancer. And at the second time, and at the second level, methane that's released into the atmosphere is one of the strongest greenhouse gases. And the burning of it creates carbon, which is also heating. It's all heating up our atmosphere, hottest year on record. And heating up the planet causes environmental stress, and environmental stress equals death. And I'm looking at a headline that says, weather extremes could cause plague of mosquitoes. So one feeds on the other. So I say, it's time to get back to good health, Tom. Let's get solar.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, Harvey, except that the plague, I'm assuming you're talking about bubonic plague, can be spread by mosquitoes. I'm pretty sure it's only spread by fleas.
Uh-huh.
But I might be wrong. I've never seen mosquitoes mentioned as a plague vector, but you know, who knows? But your concept is absolutely spot on. Brilliant, very well said, Harvey. Thank you for the call, Jim in Scappoose, Oregon. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey,
I was reading my Sierra magazine, and you know, they were hitting Obama over the head with Solyndra. They lost $500 million.
Mm-hmm.
turns out that they're actually making the government $5 billion.
Is that Cylinder, or is that the entire portfolio of loans and incentives that went out to alternative energy companies with the stimulus bill? Because my understanding is that the entire portfolio has done really, really well. Our government is making a profit on it. We as a society are doing well. There were a few of those investments that didn't work out, like Cylindra. There are others that were just spectacular.
Cylindra has a side company where it's not solar, but which they lost the money. It's these flywheels.
Mm-hmm.
Where flywheels store energy. And those things are working great, you know, like this. They spin, and they're actually better than batteries and last longer than batteries.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, so they're making a lot of money on that investment.
I'm going to have to dig that up. Jim, thank you for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. No, thank you for the call. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee, you wanted to juxtapose two stories the way I was earlier?
Yes. You know, the ancient city of Assyria, Uruk, is being destroyed by ISIS.
Correct.
And this is being described as a war crime. And I think it's similar to what is being done in the Tonto National Forest in Arizona, where the Hohokam archaeological sites are about to be destroyed by the Resolution Copper Mining Company. You probably read about this in Science magazine. It was the lead news story. Some Republican slipped in a provision.
It was John McCain.
The defense spending bill.
Yeah, it was John McCain.
980 hectares, according to my math, which I hope is right, it's 2,421.5 acres of land from Arizona's Tonto National Forest is being traded for what land, I don't know, to the Resolution Copper Mining Company. And this is not only an archaeological site, but a sacred place for the Apaches.
Yep. The Apache Tears thing. Yeah, this was John McCain who threw that into the appropriations bill. And you're right. You're absolutely right. It's a horrible, horrible thing. Thanks for the call, Bob. We look at the destruction of the basis of our own civilization with horror, but the destruction of Native American civilization.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
There are so many Native American artifacts and sites around this country that have been destroyed by us with kind of the same wanton abandon as ISIS. Amazing. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And John in Minneapolis, Minnesota, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I wanted to add a comment, too. Every teacher should read Beginning to Write by Brenda Yulin, and they wouldn't destroy, you know, the children, their creativity. They would be, I think, develop a real deep understanding of what is meant by individual creativity. And so I just wanted to throw that out there. It's just a small book. It was written by the grandmother of the person who started the Utney Reader, and it was a bestseller way back in like 1930s or something. But
Eric Utney's grandma.
Yeah, and it's just every educator, particularly in the arts, should read this book.
Yeah.
But anyway, what I really wanted to talk about was, you know, Carl's statement. You know, how is it that, you know, people live parallel lives, and how is it that some people, you know, have compassion and understanding for the people around them, and other people are so isolated and only can think of their own individualistic needs and wants and whatnot. It just seems, you know, that's a problem, particularly, you know, it's a problem for democracy because, you know, I'm a liberal or I'm a progressive because I am interested in what happens to African Americans on the other side of town or whoever. And, you know, people who are suffering as a result of structural policies, you know, that happen through the government. I'm very much interested in that. And so I know Bernie had mentioned, you know, he's waiting for a change of consciousness in, you know, and I thought that was really well said as far as before he wants to run, he wants to see enough people really, I think, you know, understand what being a liberal or a progressive is. For me, it's a spiritual issue too.
Mm.
So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there because I think it's interesting. You know, why is it that some people are just so much more compassionate than others? And how can we encourage that? Because I think that's what's underlying a lot of the problems, that we have.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm with you. Very well said, John. Thank you. Thank you for that. Very, very well said. Jose in Irwin, Tennessee. Hey, Jose, we got a minute to the break.
Yeah, I just want to talk about how Barack Obama's presidency went bad just because he was black. You've talked about how the messenger is just important, is just as important as a messenger, as a message. And Barack Obama had a center-left message, but it came in the version of the body of a black man, and that's why his presidency of, I think if he was a white man from Texas, his presidency would have gone down as one of history's greatest.
The way that Lyndon Johnson.
I think we need to nominate Jim Webb. I think he's very palatable to a white conservative community, a white Southern community, and he could really.
Jose, if you want to be if you want to be acceptable to a white conservative community, you need to be running a Republican. I'm serious. It's you know, Harry Truman said it, and I think it was brilliant. He said, Americans are not stupid. If they're presented with a choice between a Democrat who behaves like a Republican or a real Republican, they'll pick the real Republican every time. And, you know, Jim Webb, you know, on some areas he's a good Democrat. On other areas he's a good Republican. He's a real hawk. I would have a real problem with that. Jose, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It is 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
President Obama spoke about civil rights today during a radio interview ahead of his visit to Selma, Alabama, this weekend on the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. He will be giving remarks tomorrow from the Edmund Pettus Bridge. He said some quite interesting things. He talked about possible deportation of dreamers. He said the notion that some kid that was brought here when he was 2 or 3 years old might somehow be deported at the age of 20 or 25, even though they've grown up as American, that's not who we are. That's not true to the spirit of what the March on Selma was about.
Wow. Wow, conflating civil rights and immigrant rights. That's strong stuff. That's going to really stir up the Tea Party.
Yeah. Yeah. He also linked the Selma March to the fight for gay rights, saying that at its core, the civil rights movement was about affirming the basic principle that we treat people fairly.
Yeah.
So he said that. He also painted the Ferguson report as atypical. He said, I don't think it's typical of what happens across the country, but it's not an isolated incident. He talked about circumstances in which trust between communities and law enforcement have broken down. He also lamented that black Americans disempower ourselves by not voting. He said, when it comes to voting, we still see big chunks of the community disenfranchised. He talked about part of it's the responsibility of Congress. He said, but when you think about the mighty battles that were fought, the notion that you'd only have a third or a half of African Americans voting at this stage, that is not living up to the legacy that has been presented.
Yeah, the other half of that is that I think it's 27% of African Americans born today can expect to be caught up in the criminal justice system at some point in their lives, and
right.
And that in many states where if you have been a felon, you know, you've for the rest of your life lose your right to vote. There's 600,000 or 700,000 such people just in Florida. And if they had the right to vote, Florida politics would be completely different.
Exactly, exactly. And some states are trying to making small moves to change that.
Right. But not in any state run by Republicans.
Exactly. It's not widespread, that change. U.S. employers added jobs at a solid pace in February, and the unemployment rate ticked down, considered by analysts to be signs of a strengthening labor market that is likely to keep the Federal Reserve on track to raise interest rates this year. Non-farm payrolls grew by a seasonally adjusted 295,000 jobs in February, the Labor Department said. And the economy has now added more than 200,000 jobs for 12 straight months. That's the longest such streak since 1995. The unemployment rate for February came in at 5.5%, down from January's 5.7%.
So the economy is better than it's been since the last time we had a Democrat in the White House.
That would be correct.
Yeah, okay. That would be the headline that I would be pushing out to the New York Times if I was the DNC.
Maybe you should be on their payroll.
Yeah, yeah. They don't listen to me. Anyhow, back to you.
Vice President Joe Biden today, in an interview for the HBO series Vice, he blasted climate change skeptics like Senator Jim Inhofe, Republican of Oklahoma, said it's increasingly difficult for them to intelligently argue their case. I think it's close to mindless. I think it's like, you know, almost like denying gravity now, he said. Right. He said, the willing suspension of disbelief can only be sustained so long. The expression my dad also always uses is, reality has a way of intruding, he said.
Yeah, well, it'll be sustained as long as the campaign contributions continue to come from the fossil fuel industry.
Or as long as Inhofe has fun throwing snowballs on the Senate floor.
There you go. Yep.
Treasury Secretary Jack Lew today sent Speaker John Boehner a letter saying that he is preparing to deploy extraordinary measures to avoid default as the nation's debt limit again takes effect. No, it's not Groundhog Day. It is coming up to that debt limit again.
So the 15th, a week from Sunday, is the day that Jack Lew says we're going to run out of money on the Ides of March. With the last time we ran out of money, he did what he called extraordinary measures, which he referred to in this letter to the president today, or to the Speaker of the House today. How long will those extraordinary measures hold out before we are actually facing a crisis?
Well, they're quite extraordinary, actually. You can probably make them last till about September, October, November.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they'll be able to run for, until the end of the fiscal year without freaking out?
Yeah, they can run till the fall TV season.
Wow. Okay. Which in all probability the Republicans will force them to do, right?
Yes, and then we could see a very interesting showdown, because then you have a completely Republican-controlled Congress who is definitely going to want something from the president in response for a clean debt hike.
Right. Very interesting.
And the president's not going to want to give anything.
Right, and it's all going to get tangled up in Republican presidential primary politics, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. What else is up, Victoria?
The State Assembly in Wisconsin today approved legislation barring unions from requiring workers to pay the equivalent of dues, leaving Wisconsin poised to become the 25th state with what advocates describe as a right-to-work law.
Right to work for less.
That is what advocates say.
That's what I call it. You know, in right-to-work-for-less states, the average worker makes around $5,800 a year less. The average household makes around $6,500 a year less, and you are 54% more likely to die on the job in a right-to-work-for-less state. Why is it that the good citizens of Wisconsin don't know those statistics?
I don't know the answer to that, Tom.
Okay. All right. Well, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com, and Free-Don. Victoria, always great to see you. Thank you for dropping by.
Thank you very much, Tom.
We will be back. It is Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman program. And we'll be back with more of the news of the day and your thoughts, my thoughts. Oh, and Professor Richard Seeger is going to drop by at the top of the hour. Stick around. This is going to be fascinating.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us, Professor Richard Seeger of the Palisades Geophysical Institute, the Lamont Research Professor, Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory of Columbia University, ldeo.columbia.edu is the website. And Professor Seeger, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Tell us about the relationship between climate change and the war in the Middle East.
Yeah, well, you're referring to a paper that we published by Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences earlier this week. And in that paper, we analyzed a drought, a severe multi-year drought from 2006-2010. So it lasted about 3 years that preceded the uprising in Syria in 2010. And what we found was that that drought was of an unprecedented length and severity and led to a collapse of the agricultural region of northern Syria, leading to about 1.5 million Syrians leaving that area, migrating to the cities. The 3 year length of the drought was very important because farmers there can maybe survive 1 year. 2 years, their reserves are pretty much going, but if a drought goes on for 3 years, they pretty much have no ability to stay on the land anymore. So this huge migration to the cities, where they joined another 1.5 million refugees who had fled to Syria away from the war in Iraq. So in a matter of a few years, you had the population of Syrian cities growing by 3 million people. That's about 30% or more of the population. And reading through the events as they transpired in 2008, 2009, 2010, this put enormous stress on food prices, on unemployment, on housing prices, health systems, education systems. And we feel that this was one of the contributing factors, not the only contributing factor, but one of the contributing factors that led to the unraveling of Syrian society in 2010. That then led on to the all-out civil war that is still ongoing. Now, the important thing about this drought is that most of our team were climate scientists, and using some statistical techniques and climate modeling, we were able to demonstrate that a drought of this length and severity, critically the 3 years, was made 2 to 3 times more likely by the presence in the eastern Mediterranean of a long-term trend towards drier and warmer conditions that is being caused by rising greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, so by global warming, essentially. The Eastern Mediterranean turns out to be a region of the world where drying is strong and proceeding rather rapidly. So that signal of human-driven climate change is rearing its head above the background noise of natural variability. So not only did the drought contribute to the migration, which contributed to the unrest in Syria, but the drought itself was made far more likely by the fact of human-driven climate change within the Middle East.
Now, a lot of the Middle Eastern chaos, I mean, clearly we can track an awful lot of it back to George W. Bush's decision to bomb basically Afghanistan and Iraq back to the Stone Age. But on top of that, you look at the so-called Arab Spring, which started in Tunisia, a country which is very much right on the edge right now. I remember a few years back hearing that Tunisia also was suffering a record drought and that the government was not able to maintain the price supports for wheat in particular during that era, and that had something to do with the circumstances which led that street vendor to set himself on fire that tripped the whole Tunisian thing. Do you know about that?
Yeah, that was around about the same time that was going on, and there was a lot of discussion then in Egypt and Tunisia about rising food prices, and that was being related to the shock to the global food supply system at that time related to droughts in Europe, parts of Europe, and over towards Russia, Australia, and so on. So that was kind of like a remote effect that it was affecting food prices worldwide, and it was pointed to as being a contributing factor to the uprisings across the Arab region around about 2010. In this case, for Syria, I mean, those stresses would have been operating as well, but we were looking at a very specific case of something that was happening within that country and within the Middle East itself, so that people were feeling the local effects of climate change and how that was impacting drought and the agricultural system within Syria. And Syria has quite a large agricultural industry, so there was a lot to impact there.
Mm.
Going back to your prior comment, though, I mean, you know, it's not clear that if we only had the drought there, that there would have been the unraveling of the Syrian society. The drought was playing out on top of what you mentioned. There were 1.5 million Iraqis that had fled the war and to Syria. So Syria was already feeling a huge burden. And then there was this knock-on effect of a climate change-influenced drought on top of that. So they were being hit hard by multiple destabilizing factors at the same time.
So in essence, we can, if we want to know the origin of ISIS and all the horrors and freak show that's going on in the Middle East right now, we can track it back to in large part, to the confluence of George W. Bush's foreign policy and his party's global climate change policy, which is do nothing, keep burning fossil fuels.
Well, you said that, not me. I mean,
yes.
I'm
the political guy. You're the scientist. I'll say that.
I've said this before, and I'm not afraid to say it again. I mean, the whole fallout began with the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. And I remember when the war in Iraq was under full flow, there were many reports saying, look at all these people who are in Syria, you know, and Jordan, and, you know, this could easily destabilize those countries. And maybe that was going to happen anyway, with just the war. But then with the climate change influenced drought occurring on top of that, that was really enough to push that next domino over. Now, it's not over. The whole story hasn't finished yet, because now Syrian refugees are flooding into Lebanon and Jordan. Those two countries have been affected by this drought. They're going to be shifted towards a warmer, drier climate as a consequence of climate change. They're water-stressed areas already. So that climate change influence is going to be playing out as an additional stress.
And this is really just it's kind of a leading indicator, is it not? I mean, you've got the Indus Valley, you've got all large chunks of India, Pakistan, Bangladesh that are watered by glacial melt out of the Himalayas, and the glaciers are going away. You've got large chunks of South America that are watered by glacier melt out of the Andes, and those glaciers are going away. I mean,
but there are many other places in the world where there are similar processes. Mexico is a country that is also likely to experience a drying climate as well, and we can understand that there.
Right, and the American Southwest, for that matter.
And of course, the American Southwest, which is where an awful lot of my research is. But we trust that in the Western United States, we'll be able to manage it a little bit better. But you know, Syria was an incredibly vulnerable state, and Lebanon is,
right.
Jordan is, and matters are will get worse due to climate change there. So we've got to really keep an eye on this and try to plan for and try to prevent the worst from happening. But as you know, I mean, the region is in such dire straits right now that
Well, this is the stuff the Pentagon was predicting two decades ago, when in their early analysis of global climate change, that it would lead to economic and then political destabilization.
Absolutely. They use the term threat multiplier, which I think is actually a very, conceptually a very good way of looking at it.
What was that term again?
Threat multiplier.
Oh, threat multiplier. Yes. So, yeah, absolutely. Climate change is a threat.
Climate change may not be the only thing, but when you combine it with other sources of stress, and our experience, we don't have a lot to do with the military, but our experience is when we have come into contact that, you know, U.S. And United Kingdom, I'm pretty sure, military people have
hang on just a second.
Tom Hartman program.
Professor Richard Seeger, Palisades Geophysical Institute, Lamont Research Professor at Columbia University. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks for dropping by. Great talking with you. And welcome back. Ed, watching Free Speech TV in Saginaw, Michigan. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, we printed millions and millions of dollars. Why can't Russia and all those other countries print their own money?
Russia can and does. The other countries in Europe can't because, or at least those who use the euro, because the euro is controlled by the European Central Bank out of Brussels. And so Greece and Spain and Italy and Portugal, they've all given up their own, the right to produce their own sovereign currency, which in my opinion is one of the big crises that they're facing economically and politically. But certainly many other countries can and do, and sometimes to their detriment, sometimes to their benefit.
Why is our news always reporting that Russia's going down?
Well, because we're harming, you know, we're our sanctions are making it difficult for Russia to do business, and the Saudis and the banksters in the United States getting together and crashing the price of oil is really hurting Russia because the oil is their principal export. And
the price of oil is going up. I don't know if you've seen that or not.
Yeah, but it's not. It's gone from, you know, $45 to $55 a barrel. It's not anything close to the $100 a barrel that it was at 6 months ago. And
right.
And Russia really can't function well, from what I've read, with oil below $70 or $80 a barrel. And you know, Iran is facing a similar problem. Venezuela is facing similar problems. A lot of these oil-producing states. And the frackers in the United States are facing similar problems, all of which inure some benefit to the Saudis, and which is why they're doing this. But
everybody's saying Russia's going down, but you just said they could print money. So why are they going to go down?
Well, being able to print money is no guarantee of anything. It means that you're able to you can increase and reduce your money supply in ways that reflect the increase or reduction in the size of your economy, which is how it's supposed to work, so that, you know, a dollar or a ruble or whatever it may be always buys roughly the same amount. The number of dollars circulating is equal to the size of the economy. If the economy grows 5%, you print 5% more dollars, and that way the value of a dollar doesn't change. And you know, presumably the Russian Central Bank is doing the same thing with the ruble. On the other hand, when you have an external factor that affects virtually every dimension of your economy that throws prices either up or down, that can cause an economic crisis. And this happened in the United States late 60s and early 70s when you had two wars in the Middle East, and we had twice the Arabs cut the oil off to the United States. That produced a lot of inflation because we had a core commodity. Basically, everything in America is based on the price of oil. We grow our food with oil. We make our fertilizer out of oil. We use oil to plant our crops, to transport our food. And so basically the price of everything went up because the price of oil doubled and tripled back in the 70s. And it took, you know, what, 8-10 years to wring that inflation out. I'm guessing that now Russia is looking at deflation in oil. Deflation and depression are kind of synonymous. So this is a crisis for them. Any kind of huge swing in a commodity is essential as oil. I mean, I can't think of anything. Maybe oil, iron, coal. I don't know what other resources would be that fundamental, that core to an economy. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman here with you. It is estimated, this is from the 2008 ruling against ExxonMobil in New Jersey, The court said it was estimated in 1977 that at least some 7 million gallons of oil ranging in thickness from 7 to 17 feet are contained in the soil and groundwater underlying a portion of the former Bayonne site alone. This is part of New Jersey. This was former Judge Ross R. Anzaldi. He said the level of hydrocarbon contamination was so high one creek was covered with a gelatinous oily emulsion overlaying gray silt. I'm reading from Robert Henley's piece in today's Salon magazine, salon.com. The title is Christie's Oily Exxon Deal. The smell is terrible, but the stench this deal gives off is even worse. Why would Chris Christie settle? ExxonMobil owes New Jersey billions of dollars, and Chris Christie said, we'll take $250 million. Give us 3 cents on the dollar, and we'll be happy. Why would he do that? There's more to this story, and it's going to come out. Ted in Stewart, Illinois. Hey, Ted, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, let me take you off speaker.
Sure. You still there, Ted? It's taken a long time to get me off speaker.
Hello, Tom?
Yeah, you're on the air, Tom.
Oh, sorry. I wanted to talk about the Israeli and Iranian thing.
Yeah.
First, a little background. The taxpayers in this country aren't allowed to pay for abortions. But if you remember last year, we were paying for Israel to bomb schools.
Well, and Israel has a very liberal abortion on demand policy nationwide.
Yeah, well, at the same time, I believe the Israelis don't have to pay for their education in college.
I don't know.
I think so, but we're about $1 trillion in debt for our student loans.
Right.
Now I'm thinking instead of giving aid in the form of bombs and military equipment, that we instead take that money and help Iran build solar and windmills,
and then that way
they would not have to rely so much on the nuclear aspect.
Yeah,
and that would basically save the taxpayers of America from killing children with bombs, and it would save the Iranians from building nuclear power plants because we're giving them. I mean, I don't know how much money we give to Israel every year for
about $3 billion.
All right. Well, if we were to get $3 billion instead of giving them bombs, we gave them windmills and solar power. I think Iranians would be a lot more happier.
Well, Israel's building windmills and solar power like there's no tomorrow. It's one of the most solarized countries in the world. But I get your point, and in fact, I would take it beyond that. I think that we need to solarize Afghanistan, Iraq, and any other country where we are dropping bombs or drones, Syria, Lebanon, Somalia, all of those countries, we need to be going in. We need to be building schools for girls, and we need to be helping them jumpstart or leapfrog right over the whole carbon curve, right from burning fossil fuels into, or not, many of them are not even yet burning fossil fuels. They're still burning, scrap wood and little trees and things. Jump them right over that into solar collectors. I'm with you, Ted. Tim, in New Braunfels, Texas. Hey, Tim, am I saying that right?
Yeah, you're saying it right. Good to talk to you, Tom. I listen to your program every day religiously. I can't wait to hear the audio version of your book. Sounds really interesting.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Sirius.
Oh, yeah. I have to admit, I very rarely agree with you. I enjoy listening to your program, but I don't often agree with you. But one thing that gets me is I do enjoy listening to your point of view on a lot of things, but sometimes I feel that you manipulate statistics a tad bit or kind of change the point of view a little bit. And I guess both sides of the aisle really do it. But a good example, I think, is the Ferguson case. And, again, if the department is racist or if they have any of that in there, and I've never been to Ferguson, I don't live in Ferguson, but if they
You can read the emails online, Tim. where the cops and the department are making racist jokes with each other, and where but the biggest thing that the DOJ found was not so much the racial stuff, although that's there. You know, you've got roughly slightly more than 80% African American community, but 95% of the arrests and police violence incidents involved African Americans. But the bigger issue is that the chief of police and the city council are corresponding about the fact that, hey, we raised $2 million last year by passing out, you know, by tickets and fines, including stopping people and fining them for the way they walk down the street, which is what Darren Wilson stopped Michael Brown for, and you know, giving them tickets and things. And then they said, hey, can you do 10% more this year? It's like a police department should not be a revenue source for a town. And then on top of that, you have a largely white police department in a largely black community. The results of that are going to be fairly predictable. So they, you know, this is not about manipulating statistics, Tim. It's about common sense.
Well, no, I agree with what you're saying as far as, and first of all, I want to say I have heard about the emails. I think that's completely appalling. But, you know, it would make sense in a community like Ferguson, which is predominantly black, that more black people are going to get stopped and more black people are going to get tickets and whatnot. I mean, I'm a white individual. I live in Texas. I'm 30 something years old, and I've been pulled over for not wearing a seatbelt. I've been pulled over and ticketed for having a headlight out. You know, I mean, all of these things.
Tim, so have I for both those things, actually, in the course of my life. But the difference that you and I experience from the people living in Ferguson is that as white people, you and I are not targeted. Black people in Ferguson, according to the Department of Justice, and this is our, you know, top organization in the country, this is an FBI investigation. The black people in Ferguson are specifically targeted by the police department. And I think that we both can agree to condemn that. Tim, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And if you think it's just happening in Ferguson, Missouri, I got a bridge to sell you. We'll be back. Before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. It's Anything Goes Friday, and Brian in Ithaca, New York, listening to WNYY. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to share some good news coming out of New York State. I live in Ithaca, and we, New York State, as you know, recently banned fracking, so I just wanted to give a shout-out for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm driving to my hometown of Buffalo, New York, currently. I'm just driving through the beautiful Finger Lakes. And I wanted to bring up get your thoughts on this, that a number of years ago, you know, the Chinese were dumping solar panels on the United States. So they put a tariff on them. And as a result of that, they are now building the largest solar panel factory in North America, in Buffalo, New York, on an old, on the old Republican steel site. And I just think it's so amazing how quickly we could turn things around in this country if we had the political will to do it. That factory is going to employ 3,000 people. They're building it currently as we speak. It's Solar City, Elon Musk. So it's not some, you know, it's a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you want a great example of how quickly we can turn on a dime and start producing things that are necessary, look at World War II. We went from making cars to making tanks and airplanes. We went from making nylon stockings to making parachutes. We went from making, you know, socks and clothes to making uniforms. We did it. And we can mobilize like that right now to stop global climate change, the greatest threat to the human race that's ever happened. All we have to do is get these climate change deniers out of the way, and you know, it's, which is going to be a challenge as long as ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers keep giving them money. But, yeah, I'm with you, Brian, and tariffs is a great idea. Thank you. Bill in St. Helens, Oregon. Hey, Bill. Conservatives?
Hey, Tom. Basically, this is just a discussion on the topic of progressive versus conservative values.
Mm-hmm.
So you and I meet for the first time, and before we go any further, I think, Tom, you should know a few things about me. I am incapable of error. I literally never make a mistake. In all things, my will is the only one that matters. If anything bad happens, well, that's your fault, Tom.
Sounds like you're a libertarian.
If let me go through. If you disagree with me, you're un-American, unpatriotic, and you should be marginalized or exterminated. I have the right to total control and final say in all matters that affect Americans. If I lose an election, it is my duty to destroy the ability of the governing party to govern, and there's no level I will not stoop to smear those I don't like.
Oh, now it sounds like you're a Republican.
No, I'm trying to be facetious here.
I'm
saying
okay.
These are the values I'm hearing espoused continuously. When's the last time you heard a conservative take responsibility for anything? They're
yeah.
the party of perfection, Tom. They never make mistakes, and they certainly never admit to it. They never make mistakes. They never, literally never do anything wrong. Just ask conservatives. You're saying ask them what they've done positively. Ask them what they've done negatively. And the answer is, well, nothing. We never do anything bad.
Well, some of the things that they've done are things like restricting voting rights with voter ID, voter suppression bills, expanding the number of guns that are available by doing away with the assault weapons ban. They're fighting cop killer bullets now against, in defiance of virtually every police department in the country. And Drudge runs headlines saying Democrats want to ban popular ammunition. Sorry, cop killer bullets, well, they may be popular, but, not with anybody who has a reasonable reason to have a gun. Yeah, I get it. Yeah, Bill.
You're making my point. How many of those things have they ever taken responsibility for? When you ask them, I asked a very good conservative friend of mine who I thought was very intelligent and well-educated. I said, what about this voter disenfranchisement? He says, well, I think it's our duty to keep people, from fraudulently voting. I said, even though maybe keeping one potential fraudulent voter disenfranchises 400,000, that's equitable. And he goes, well, we just can't know that. I said, you're really not getting the point here. And,
yeah. Well, and he's the big point is the one that Ben Franklin made about the death penalty. He said it would be better to have 100 people go free than that one person who is not guilty be executed.
Totally, totally. So now I'm trying to make a case saying that they're extremists in a very undesirable way. And
I agree. They're not revolutionaries. They're reactionaries, and they're not conservatives. They're reactionaries. I'm with you, Bill. Thank you for the call, Joe in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey. Yeah. Thanks for the call. I saw, we had more economic statistics come out with the employment records, about 250 more jobs. And it always amuses me greatly to hear people like you and other people that kind of like to spread economic ignorance to the public that somehow this is caused by Obama's policies. And in fact, you just in your other cut about a half hour ago said this should be the number one ad for the DNC.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to ask you, if you think Obama caused this economic growth, which I'm not even think if real economists understand that it's really not that great,
right.
But if you think it is, which policy exactly did it? Was it the fact that Republicans, quote, don't get anything done in Congress for the last several years? Did that cause it? Or was it because the extended unemployment benefits got repealed? Did that cause it? Or is it because conservatives, quote, try to stop everything Obama does and he can't get anything done? Does that cause it? Well, you'll probably say Obamacare. You'll probably say, a bunch of other stuff that are just unprovable. And I'm not saying any, it's just an example of this country's really terrible economic ignorance.
If you look at how the Federal Reserve responded to the market crash in 1929, they tightened up access to money. And that made that depression deeply, profoundly worse. This was Ben Bernanke's PhD thesis. And so a large part of what has put our economy back together is the Fed. And I think that they went way beyond arguably what they needed to do because they literally were bailing out the world when Senator Sanders and Ron Paul passed that audit the Fed for 1 year bill. They looked at 2008, what the Fed did, and they had loaned out over $30 trillion, much of it going to individual billionaires in the United States and around the world. Deutsche Bank, banks in the Middle East were being bailed out by the Fed. So there was that. And then there was the stimulus. If you look very simply at the unemployment rate, put that on a graph along with the beginning of the stimulus that happened, shortly after Obama became president, you can see that the month after the stimulus was passed and the money started flowing, so it'd really be about 6 weeks out, unemployment at that point the unemployment rate was going up. We were losing between 700,000 and 900,000 jobs a month, and that loss slowed down to 500,000 jobs a month, and the next month it slowed down to 300,000 jobs a month, and the next month it slowed down to 100,000 jobs a month, and then it went positive, and it's been positive ever since. So I'd say it was the combination, Joe, of the Obama stimulus, which was nowhere near large enough. This was the point that Robert Reich was making at the time. There was a two, and Paul Krugman and a whole bunch of other good economists, $2.5 trillion hole was blown in the side of our economy by the banksters and what they did once the Republicans deregulated them. Phil Graham's, Graham Leach Bliley, blowing up Glass-Steagall, and we filled that $2.5 trillion hole with about an $800 billion stimulus, a third of which was just tax cuts for rich people, which did absolutely nothing to stimulate the economy. So the stimulus was way too small, which is why we're still in pain, many would argue. I would say it goes beyond that, that our structural problems, structural problems that lead back to Reaganomics 101, the accumulation of massive amounts of power and wealth by a small number of corporations, putting out of business all the medium-sized companies in this country. There virtually are none left in any major industry. And small companies just, they try to reach the point where they can be bought up or bought out as quickly as possible. That's the new business plan. You've got that. We've lost our manufacturing base because we did away with tariffs, and we haven't replaced them with VAT taxes like every European country did, like Taiwan did, like South Korea did, like Japan did, like China has done. We don't have our economic infrastructure is badly, badly broken. And that's, the essence of that is all. That's my book, The Crash of 2016, why that is. Joe, thanks for the call. Lawrence in Berkeley. Hey, Lawrence, what's on your mind?
Hi, something completely different.
Okay.
the most interesting story that you won't find in the mass media is about Cuba. Cuba is in the process of possibly becoming a real Marxist socialist society. In other words, they are replacing state-controlled industry with co-ops.
Right.
This is happening. Well, it started happening in the mid '90s with agriculture, because otherwise they would have starved. And now in 2011, they passed a law allowing non-agricultural companies to become independent co-ops.
Right. Right.
And
it's happening all over the country.
Yeah. And in fact, there is a United States-Cuba Cooperative Working Group, and the United States side of it is the National Cooperative Business Association, which is down there cooperating with Cuban co-ops. And you can find this, there's many sources of it that are, of course, not on the national web.
Right.
But there's a dissident Havana, it's a dissident newspaper from Cuba that is online. It's called the Havana Times.
Okay, I'll have to check that out.
HavanaTimes.org.
In my book, Threshold, Louise and I went to Mondragon and saw what was going on there. I went to Madison, saw, Union Cab and Peninsula Engineering and others, and manufacturing rather, and suggested that co-ops are the alternative to capitalism that really could save this country. And, it may well happen in Cuba. Lawrence, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day here on Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. 15 minutes before the hour, Morris, listening to KPFK in Long Beach, California. Hey, Morris, what's on your mind?
Professor, can the President of the United States issue an executive order allowing everyone that's been convicted of a federal crime to participate in our voting?
I don't believe so. I'm pretty sure that if you're convicted of a federal crime, you don't lose your federal right to vote, which would basically be your right to vote in senatorial, congressional, or presidential elections.
That's correct.
But that states can limit your right to vote if you are a felon. What I don't know, Morris, is whether those "you can't vote if you're a felon" laws in the states only apply to felonies committed against the state as opposed to felonies committed against the federal government. So, if somebody living in Florida, for example, has a federal felony conviction, does that mean they can't vote in Florida? I don't know the answer to the question. But I know, but I do know that the president could not say that somebody who committed a crime in Florida, say, you know, bank robbery or murder or, you know, mugging or, you know, whatever. I mean, pick your Florida felony. If it was a state felony, the president cannot issue an executive order saying that the state of Florida must recognize that person's right to vote. That has to happen in the Florida legislature because the Constitution very clearly says that the manner and time of elections shall be determined by the states and who's eligible to vote. That's all there. And really, this is one of the most horrible legacies of slavery. I think that if there had not been slavery in the United States from the very beginning, the right to vote would have been listed as one of our rights in the Constitution. They just didn't want to put that in there, A, because of the slaves, and B, because of women. And it should have been in there. It's not too late. I mean, we should have an absolute positive and affirmative right to vote, and whether by constitutional amendment or by statute. And we don't have that, which is why Alec and you know, is pushing all these voter suppression laws. Morris, thanks for the call. I'll have to do some research. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Tom. I wanted to talk about the tar baby. I'll try to be as quick as I can. Everybody keeps talking about how the country is 62% in favor of going into Syria and fighting ISIS. Well, excuse me, but how are we going to pay for this? And first of all, why should we do it? How are we going to pay for it? Where are the people going to come from? Are they going to have to reinstate the draft? You know, why can't we have sanctions against every country on the Arabian Peninsula until they stop funding this?
Bernie Sanders sent a press release out about 3 hours ago that I got, and nearly printed out to read on the air, but I figured, you know, we'll have Bernie on next week and he'll talk about it. Saudi Arabia has basically called for U.S. boots on the ground in Syria and in Iraq. And Bernie is going, hey, wait a minute. You've got Saudi Arabia has the third largest military budget in the world. Why are they demanding that we put boots on the ground in their backyard when they can put boots on the ground in their own backyard? And, you know, I mean, it's sort of a rhetorical question on Bernie's part, because the clear answer is that ISIS is Sunni, Saudi Arabia is Sunni, they're all Wahhabists, they're all Salafites, they're brothers in arms, as it were, at least in my opinion. Norma, thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman. Happy birthday, Sneezy. To my executive producer, Sean Taylor. To our associate producers, Shane Farnan, Daniel Gilday, and Troy Miller. To our video director, Jim Javinsky. To our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet. To Alva Goldberg for video production. To our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly. To our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum. To all the organizations that syndicate this program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, including Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Radio, and to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you so much. We would not be here without you. It's absolutely the truth. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind?
Hey, hi, Tom. Happy birthday, Louise, and thanks, Tom, for going on the offense on the conservatives.
Okay, thank you, Jesse. What's up?
Hey, journalism, I think, is about the most important profession in this world right now, because once you finish school, the only way you can learn is from the news.
Mm-hmm.
So journalists are under a lot of pressure right now. So I would think journalists would think that they would need to really go into context on reporting solution to humanity's problems these days. What
yeah.
do you think?
I agree. I mean,
really go into context and solutions. You've been going on the offense.
Yeah.
We need context to saying why didn't the New Deal work and why are we still at each other's throats and why do one part of the economy profit on another part of the economy when it's in misery.
Well, Jesse, the New Deal did work, and that was, it was a, in a way, a victim of its own success, because by the time Reagan came along and started undoing the New Deal, everybody just assumed that, hey, this middle-class prosperity, this is just the natural state of things. So if Reagan tinkers around the edge, it's not going to screw up my life. Little did everybody realize that Reagan was, you know, injecting cancer into our system.
It didn't work enough, whereas the people are,
I'm listening. Jesse? Yeah, Jesse's gone. Elton in Lima, Ohio. Hey, Elton, what's up?
How are you?
Good.
Something regarding the filibuster, actually, and the Republicans are complaining about the Democratic filibusters.
Right.
And realize that Obama called for them to get rid of the filibuster. If they did that, and McConnell will never get rid of it, we would have a track record of everything the Republicans do. Obama can still veto legislation. And come 2016, it would be the worst thing in the world for the Republicans to have a track record that we could point to.
Well, they already have a pretty horrible track record. And as I keep pointing out, there is nothing that conservatives have done in the last 240 years in this country that has moved this country forward. Nothing. All they keep promoting things that hold us back. And that record still doesn't get used against them the way I think it should. I so mourn the loss of Harry Truman Democrats who will take names and kick ass. Elton, thank you for the call. Devon in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Devon, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, on this issue of public-private partnerships,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of people aren't aware that we got ready for World War II by the federal government assumed the flooring costs for the construction of ammunition plants around the country.
Right.
And that agreement kind of got perverted to the point where today private companies are running these government-owned plants and doing all kinds of horrific things. But the fact remains, we could not have gotten ready for World War II without the government providing the funding to build and equip the plants.
Right. You're absolutely right, Devon. And this is the same thing. If we look at global warming right now as being as great a threat to the world as Adolf Hitler was, and frankly, I think the global warming is a greater threat than Adolf Hitler was, then we really need to go on war footing, as it were. I'm not a big fan of war metaphors. But, you know, everybody needs to be pitching in, and we need to be throwing everything we have at this. And instead, we've got, you know, the Koch brothers and the and ExxonMobil funding these right-wing cranks and James Inhofe and whatnot saying, oh, no, don't worry, everything's fine, you know, and by the time it gets really bad, we'll all be dead, so we shouldn't care. Devon, thank you for the call. That was an excellent point. Angela in Cumming, Georgia. Hey, Angela, it says you disagree with me?
Yes, hi, Tom. I'm going to have to be quick because I think the show is coming to an end.
Yeah.
But I do have to say real quick, I think you're a national treasure. Now, I disagree with you earlier when you were stating that you feel it's basically a lack of empathy that white people have in speaking with blacks as they mentioned the horrible things that are happening to them, especially through the police force.
Right.
I think it's actually much more basic than that. I've lived in the South my entire life. I'm born and raised in the South. Although I have to say the South has nothing on Missouri. I mean, my goodness.
Yeah.
But I think it's more basic than that. I think basically what it amounts to is, and I know this is going to sound harsh, but white people, I hate to say it, but almost the majority of them, well, more so than not, feel that black people are basically liars. I feel that they feel black people are habitual, if not congenital, liars, and they don't have to listen to anything that they say. When black people tell them about these horrible things that are happening to them, I believe white people, for the most part, feel they're either exaggerating or they're just lying. It happens to me all the time. It's happened to me in my entire life.
Yeah.
When white people, when I may say something to a white person, and they'll say, yes, and obviously not believing me. And then is when they think I'm not there to hear another white person corroborate that, there when the lights go, oh, really? Oh, now I understand.
Yeah.
I think
you're right, Angela. I think you're absolutely right. And there's also a certain amount of self-deception. It's so much more comfortable to believe that that can't be the case. And then you don't have to think about it, right? You don't have to deal with it. Angela, thank you for your contribution today. And a great call. And thank you all for being with us these 3 hours and this 5 days of this week. I hope you have a great and safe weekend. And we'll be back on Monday, same time, same place. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually requires you to show up. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.